funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the difference between fashion and style, and why have those distinctions blurred in recent decades? In the first half of the 20th century, before home economics came to be viewed as a sexist and even repressive pursuit, a remarkable group of women held influence over American taste in clothing and convincingly demonstrated it was possible to build a flattering but practical wardrobe even on a modest budget. As my guest today will tell us, the so-called dress doctors believed every woman ought to wear the proper clothes for her age, figure, and occupation, and they offered mostly timeless advice to help us understand how to do that. Linda Prebyszewski is Associate Professor of History at Notre Dame University. Her new book is called The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. Linda, welcome to Think.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
This book highlights the contributions of a group of women you call the dress doctors. Who were they and what did they do?
They were three different groups of women who sometimes overlapped, sometimes knew each other. They did read each other's works. One group was based in departments of home economics and very often worked out of land-grant universities. And they did public outreach programs, which were called extension programs. And they were all linked in some ways with the USDA, which was in charge of extension programs. And they wrote pamphlets for 4-H clothing clubs for girls. They ran demonstrations for grown women. And actually, the clothing clubs that the USDA ran for girls and women were the most popular clubs that they had. So that's one group. Another group is a group who trained people in retail. New York University in particular had several really important authors who wrote very thick books that would be used by people who wanted to become buyers at department stores or who went on to train retail clerks. And then the third group is a rather independent group of women who wrote books. They also ran their own sewing academies. They ran their own dress design academies. And they cited each other's works. I always make that clear. And sometimes people move from one group to the other. Someone worked in home economics, and then she decided she would just start writing books on her own. Some people were trained in home economics and then went on to work in retail training as well.
I love this book, Linda, because it's a reminder that for most of us, dressing well does not happen by instinct, right? It's something we have to learn how to do. And at one point, it was considered a part of a young woman's education, whereas now, as teenagers, girls are supposed to have a style without having had much instruction in that.
Right. They literally taught millions of girls and women in the early 20th century the art of dress and the craft of sewing. And although they often said that people know a monstrosity when they see it, they just might not know exactly what's wrong with it. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because they identified sets of principles which they argued were timeless and were taught to these women, as I said. But what they actually allow us to do is sometimes it just gives us a vocabulary for what is troubling us about something we've put on or seen in a store, and we're not really sure what's going on, but we know it's something wrong. And it turns out these principles could be articulated and understood by everyone. I mean, that was one of the things they said is, yes, it's true, some people seem to be born with kind of a real appreciation for color or for line, but anyone can master this knowledge.
Was this a time, Linda, when every woman was expected to be able to sew? Because I have to imagine that even when most women knew how to do it, there were varying levels of skill and of interest in designing and creating one's own clothing.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear by the early 20th century, almost every household had a sewing machine. Mm-hmm. It's something like 95% by 1925. But the ready-to-wear industry for women really takes off by the 1930s. And the dress doctors were perfectly happy to have a woman just buy her clothes off the rack, because they said, look, if you enjoy sewing, great, right? If you think it's creative, and a lot of women did. In fact, the head of the bureaus, the Bureau of Home Economics at the USDA, the head of the Division of Textiles and Clothing actually did a survey in the late 20s, and she said, why do you sew? And she had a list of answers, which were for economics, because I can't find good quality in the store, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of people penciled in, actually, I sew because I really enjoy it, because it's a creative outlet, and I love to make things with my hand. And she felt bad she hadn't put that on the survey. So, yes, there were women who could really enjoy it, but they said, look, if you are, you know, a college student and you work a part-time job and your days are full and you hate sewing, don't worry about it. Just go buy something at the store. It's, you know, if you're a mom and you've got a bunch of little kids and you're really busy and you don't enjoy sewing, we don't hold that against you at all. In fact, we think you should have free time to yourself to do what you love to do. But they said, when you go shopping in the store, when you make those choices, you can still apply the principles of art. So they said you can be an artist in creating your own clothes, or you can be an artist in choosing a beautiful ensemble that you put together from what you can find in the stores.
What's really fascinating is that this was not about money. Today we tend to associate the very best taste in clothing with people who have a great deal of, you know, cash lying around to purchase it.
Yes, and this is part of this really democratic impulse I see in these women and what they were teaching. Because just as they argued anyone could learn, right, how to create beauty in dress, they always said, look, it is not that you need a large wardrobe. It is not that you need an expensive wardrobe. Beauty is really about knowledge. So if you know how to put color harmonies together, if you can appreciate line and design, then you can find something beautiful. And realize, too, okay, these are home economists. So economical is one of their values. And so they would talk about how to budget, and they always emphasize it's better to have a small wardrobe that is beautiful, that fits your life perfectly because it fits the occasions in your life, than it is to have an enormous wardrobe, right, of a whole lot of things that don't make any sense, that aren't very beautiful, and, you know, you wear once, and then you wonder why in God's name you bought them. And so they actually sometimes said, you might notice it's not always the wealthiest people who are the best dressed because they sort of overindulge themselves and they chase every trend, and they don't always stop and think, well, is this something that's actually beautiful?
So Mary Brooks Pickin might be called the first dress doctor. Can you talk about how she created a role for herself as an authority on clothing and also on design?
Yeah, so she's a wonderful story. She was born on a farm in Kansas, and she was something of a prodigy in that she could sew and weave by the time she was 5 years old.
Wow.
And her grandmother taught her a lot of those skills, and then she tells a story about how she would actually go travel to a neighbor's lady's house to learn some more, and she would actually take more formal lessons as well in various places. But she started out teaching in Kansas, and she taught the young women at the YWCA, and she also taught for a little time, just after the turn of the 20th century, at Leavenworth Penitentiary, where there were a handful of female prisoners. And every time I think about that, I think about sewing shears and how sharp they are and what a scary enterprise that must have been on some level. But she did that. And then she moved east, and she got asked to write the pamphlets for a correspondence school, very important correspondence school in Pennsylvania, called the Women's Institute of Domestic Arts and Sciences. And she wrote all these pamphlets in the 19-teens, I think there were like 64 of them, on sewing. And so that was her first authorship that was really important. And then she ran this part of the correspondence school for years, and literally tens of thousands of women would write in asking about lessons. And it really taught an enormously large number of American women, most of them who were home women. They were mothers. They only worked in the home. But about 17% or so were women who hoped to make their own dressmaking businesses. So they took these lessons, and you got the lessons in the little pamphlets Mary Brooks Pickin had written, and then you actually did the exams at the end, and you sent in samples, and those got graded and returned to you. And if you finished everything at the end, you got your diploma.
The 19-teens were a good time for this sort of thing because American middle-class women in particular, their lives were changing a lot, and maybe the rules that had applied the previous century to their mothers and grandmothers didn't work for them anymore.
Well, the teens are an interesting period in fashion, in part because the dress reformers of the late 19th century had succeeded to a great degree in fighting against the tight corset, which they were afraid was unhealthy for women, and also against dresses that went all the way down to the ground and obviously hampered movement and might also have been dragging in all kinds of germs. So by the teens, you've got looser silhouettes, you've got shorter dresses, they're off the ground, you can actually see women's ankles, which would have been shocking in the 19th century. And World War One meant that women in the United States, to some degree, who worked in manufacturers, but also in Britain and France, obviously, women had to take on a lot of jobs that had been done by men. And so there were lots of examples of women wearing trousers, which was not normal wear at all for women at that point in time. And a lot of interest in clothing that made it easy to move. So the teens are an era in which there are changes in fashion. There are also the rise of the progressive movement and this interest in bringing to the American people, through government efforts, the fruits of science and knowledge. And that's what the dress doctors who worked at the land-grant universities in particular thought they were doing, that they wanted everyone to have the benefit of the knowledge that they had. And that's why they were always writing and teaching.
They were not fans of gals in pants, though. Am I right about that?
No, but nobody was. People are so shocked today because it's, I have to explain to my students that trousers on women did become acceptable in the 19th century, in really late 20s and through the 30s, but only for certain kinds of occasions. So one was beach pajamas, which are actually wonderful. They have really wide legs. Most of us would think a woman wearing them was wearing a skirt because they're just so wide and flowy. And so they were resort wear. They were lounge wear. Women did wear pajamas with pants at home. But otherwise, it was for sports wear. So, you know, did you go riding? Did you go hiking? Did you play golf? Those would be occasions on which women wore pants. So when people say to me, well, the dress doctors didn't like pants, I have to say, well, actually, no one did. And there's actually a survey of women in the Twin City area in the 1940s, married women, and they asked them about what was in their closets. And it turns out that each of them had less than one pair of slacks in their closets. Now, this is Minneapolis, which is freezing in the winter. Okay, so it's not as though the dress doctor told them don't wear them. Everyone agreed that they said, oh, no, don't wear trousers. That's only if you're, you know, doing sports or lounging around or at the beach or if you're doing really dirty work, like if you're painting or something, you might put on dungarees to do it in. But otherwise, dresses were really considered the most normal thing for women to wear.
Linda Prevashevsky is my guest. She's Associate Professor of History at Notre Dame University and author of the new book, The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Linda Prebyszewski. She is Associate Professor of History at Notre Dame University and author of The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Linda, talk about some of the, if they weren't hard and fast rules, certainly they were strong guidelines that the dress doctors had for helping women make good choices when it came to clothing that flattered their bodies and their lifestyles.
Well, when it came to what we call lifestyle, they would talk about the six occasions for dress, which were school, work, by which they meant business work, or travel. Those were put together. And actually, those really also fit under streetwear. And then there was housework and sports and spectator sports. And yes, spectator sports had their own clothing. And then afternoon affairs and evening affairs. So they would say, where do you spend your time? And wherever it is you spend your time, if you spend it at home, for example, because you are what they will call home woman, then that's what you should spend your money on. You should spend your money on, and at this point in time, it would have been the house dress. You would spend your money on getting some, you know, good-looking, durable, pretty house dresses and not worry about getting a long evening gown because you are actually not going to have an opportunity to wear a long evening gown. So spend your money, most of your money, on what you're going to use every day.
They would definitely have frowned upon, like, $500 shoes that hurt the moment we put them on.
Shoes have been a problem for the entire 20th century for women. There's actually a picture, I had them put in my book, of a x-ray done at the USDA that's got, on the left, there are these toes that are clearly being squished and actually sort of folding over one another. And that is a woman wearing very high, very pointy-toed heels. And then on the right is clearly a lower heel with a rounder toe box. And the slogan was, toe room means toe health.
We all should strive for toe health.
Right. And it's actually during World War One that one of the women who organized volunteers in the YWCA said, we have discovered you cannot be cheerful or efficient if you are wearing high heels. So all of our workers should wear low-heeled shoes, walking shoes, as they call them, so they can make the most of their energy and their time. And I actually have this theory. I don't know if we could prove it or not, but since women used to wear hats, I think they could express more of their frivolous impulses in hats. And today we don't wear hats, very, very rarely, and as a result, I think we're spending way too much time looking at our feet and thinking about our shoes.
Well, I was wondering if we started getting into high-heeled shoes when we were able to see the ankles and above, because if you were wearing a skirt to the floor, maybe you cared about your little kid's slippers, but people wouldn't necessarily see them easily.
Right. And it's clear that shoes, high-heeled shoes, you know, it is once you can see them. You see that from the teens onward. And that's clearly one of their complaints because they keep, you know, they say this in the teens, they say this in the 20s, they say this in the 30s. And usually what they were arguing against was the idea, well, a woman would say, yes, but my feet look better, right? They look somehow thinner or smaller or more graceful or something in a high heel. And they would say, well, actually, you're not very graceful in the high heel because you're wobbling while you walk. And you're actually distorting the human body by squashing your toes together. And they argued that the human body, the healthy human body, is beautiful in and of itself. It's beautiful in motion. And we should only wear things that allow us to move naturally.
The dress doctors always placed an emphasis on clothing that brought the eye up to the face. And it's very evident throughout the book. You have multiple pages of illustrations of the different kinds of collars and detachable neckwear that was available. This was a big deal at a certain point in our history.
Yes, it was a big deal for quite a while. And I am a dressmaker. And when I first started collecting their textbooks and also collecting sewing pattern magazines, I was stunned by the variety of collars they came up with. I didn't even have names for what these were, right? And I realized that today we make do with a very small design vocabulary of collars, but they really lavished a lot of attention, a lot of creativity on collars. And this is one of their primary art principles in action, right? Emphasize the face. And early on, they argue, well, you should emphasize the face because that is sort of the seat of spirituality. And that is what is most important about a woman, not her body, not her physical self, but her spiritual self. As time went on, they started to talk more about personality. Your face expresses your personality. You want people to look at it. And you also want people to be paying attention to what you're saying. So if they're staring down at your shoes, they may not be doing that. But if they're, you know, someone's eyes have been drawn upward really naturally by the brighter colors or the lighter colors or the more interesting design that's at the very top of the dress, well, they're going to notice your face. And they're going to listen to what you're saying.
It has struck me that particularly at a time when either ready-to-wear was quite expensive per piece or we were making clothing ourselves, it wasn't like a one-season purchase, right? People had to keep their clothes, take care of them, and then the dress doctors recommended sort of repurposing things if they felt a little tired, hang on to the piece and make it what you want it to be.
Yes, they did really believe that a garment should last 3 years. And you see, and this is why choosing the right thing was so important. You're going to live with it for a while. And they did believe in looking after your clothing. In fact, when I was teaching my students in fashion history class, they said to me, "What's darning?" Right? And darning is when there's a hole, it's a way of patching it with actual threads. And I realized there's no reason why they would have ever heard of that word because, of course, today clothing is so much less expensive as the garments industry has, you know, found poorer and poorer people to work for very little overseas. And so when something gets a hole in it, you throw it out. Whereas in their age, when something gets a hole in it, you try to catch it really early and you see if you can't patch it with threads or in some other way. And there's lots of recycling of various kinds, right? Can you cut something down? Sometimes you're changing like a woman's dress, you can turn it into a child's dress, or a man's shirt, you could turn it into a child's shirt. And other times they're just saying, well, you know, if that dress is worn out under the arms, for example, you could take a new fabric and put sleeves on in a contrasting color.
These days, Linda, we sort of assume that it's always been good advice that if you want to look effortlessly chic, you pick up something that is simple and black. The dress doctors disagreed with this.
Well, they like the word simplicity, and it's interesting to me because I think the word simple means different things in different ages. But it's really clear that black was a color they thought had lots of limitations. In the 1930s, there are two women who wrote a best-selling book of dress advice, and they said, oh, we are so sick of black. You know, at night especially, they said, look, women can wear any of the beautiful colors in the rainbow at night. Let's do it. So when people go on and on about Coco Chanel and the little black dress, I always call it the little boring dress. I sort of overdosed on black myself in the 1980s and thought, what am I doing? I look like I'm at a funeral. And there are plenty of dark colors you can wear to work if you don't, you know, you're not trying to look resplendent as you do in the evening. And they're not black. And I was sort of following the dress doctor's advice before I was even reading them. So please rethink black people.
I love the idea, as I'm getting a little bit older, that the dress doctors felt like, boy, by the time you're 40 or 50, that's when you really have a great wardrobe. Nobody expected the best looking people in the room to be the 20-year-olds.
Yes, it's fascinating that the most sophisticated designs were actually reserved for women over 30. These are drape designs. So drape designs, they use more fabric. They need to be made of a fabric that is more expensive because the draperies themselves need to fall gracefully. And the argument was, before 30, you're sort of hyperactive. You're running around. Yes, you have lots of energy, but you also have a certain silliness. And so you can't wear a drape dress well because your movements would be too jerky, and the draperies would sort of fly around in a really odd way. Whereas as you get older, I like to say, well, yes, we slow down, but thank God we also calm down. And they argued that the slower, more thoughtful pace of a woman over 30 meant that she could wear draped clothing very gracefully, and that she would be beautiful in it. She would also, because draped clothing has a certain eroticism to it, because it caresses the body in a way, she'd also be able to handle the attention she might receive from men while she was wearing that clothing, whereas a younger woman might not just be up to handling that quite yet.
You mentioned that, you know, women needed to get a house dress or two. That maybe means something different than what we imagine the term to mean today.
Yes. And in fact, I always thought of house dresses as those sort of shapeless, sad...
Zip up the front, calico.
Yeah, with a bad floral.
Right.
And then I saw house dresses from the 1930s. And they were so snappy and so pretty. And I thought, this garment has completely changed its definition. And there was a lot of attention paid to designing house dresses. I mean, they always had short sleeves because the idea was, right, you're going to be doing dirty work, washing dishes, et cetera, so they don't get in your way. But they were always of the current style, right? The hem was whatever the current fashion dictated. And the bodice and the necklines, et cetera, were some of the current styles, too. Now, obviously, these aren't draped. These are tailored. They're made of crisp, washable fabrics like cotton. But they were really nice looking. And in fact, you could wear any of these things from the 30s down the street, you know, today, and nobody would think you look dumpy. You'd actually look quite sharp.
So I live in a pretty old house now, and the one original closet left is about the size of my desk, probably smaller than my work desk. People, I suppose, owned fewer pieces by far than they do today.
Yes, they did, because realize the cost of clothing has come way down. We spend about 6% of our budgets on clothing, and they were warning women, don't spend more than 15. So you had fewer pieces, and you looked after them well, and they loved to tell stories about women with a really tiny wardrobe. Mary Brooks Pickin told a story about a businesswoman who wore the same dress to work for 2 years. And you sort of, right, you're like, oh, come on, right? But what she did was to switch out with collars and cuffs, and apparently she loved making collars and cuffs, and there were all kinds of styles you could do. You could do lace, you could do silk, you could make them big, small, draped, crisp, whatever you wanted to do. And she also darned her dress when it looked like it was going to get a hole in it. Now, that wasn't the only thing she would wear on a given day. She had an afternoon dress, she had an evening dress, and I would bet you money she also had something to wear at her home. But the idea was you could get variety, which I think we sort of need a little variety in our lives, by changing during the day for different events, right, changing the evening into something else, rather than having sort of constant variety in your entire wardrobe. And obviously the collars and cuffs were variety too.
How much room was there at this time for people to have a really distinctive style, something that sort of broke all the rules? Would that person automatically be an outcast, or was there room for her?
Well, when they talked about the principles, they often said, these are not hard and fast rules so much as they are a way to teach you to have a feel for proportion, to have a feel for color. And they really didn't think there were enormous limitations. There's so much variety, actually, you can see it in the clothing from the past, that it doesn't seem as though everyone had to dress exactly alike. And in fact, I think today we're a lot more boring. I mean, think about, you know, college students all in T-shirts and jeans. I'm not really sure that that's so much more creative than any time in the past.
One thing about clothing from the first half of the 20th century that typically strikes me as really impractical is hats, right? Because the people didn't wear hats because it was cold outside. They wore these little frippy little things that could blow off in a strong wind. What kind of advice did the dress doctors have for decorating one's head?
Okay. Well, there were, I think we tend to remember the crazy small hats more, and I think that's possibly because they've survived because they weren't worn as much. I'm serious. What was called a casual felt, which would have been a hat with a brim of some kind, and just a little decoration, maybe a feather, maybe a bow, or some sort of ribbon. That's what women wore as an everyday basis, right? And it did shade your face from the sun, and it did keep you warm in the winter, if that's what you were aiming at. So for hats for parties, though, I mean, they had no problem with them being much more frilly and much more crazy. And obviously, if you had more money and you weren't just wearing casual felts to work, then, you know, go ahead, enjoy yourself.
And did women wear these hats inside and out, or did you have to have a decent hairstyle underneath the hat?
Well, some of them did wear their hats inside, the smaller hats, especially. You will see businesswomen in old pictures who are wearing hats inside. I would say, though, plenty of the younger women who would work in offices would wear that casual felt in the streets and then come in, right, and take it off.
I was wondering this, in places like the South, you know, it's very hot in Texas. Did you have to wear pantyhose or stockings, I suppose, was the thing in the first half of the 20th century, no matter what, right?
Right. Well, yeah, stockings were, well, girdles. I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, and we could talk about this more, but the dress doctors always wanted everyone in girdles, which strikes me as crazy, but they did surveys. Again, the Bureau of Home Economics did a survey, and I think this came out in the 40s, and they discovered 85% of American women did not wear girdles on a given day.
They broke that rule.
Yes, they definitely did.
My guest is Linda Prepyshevsky. She's Associate Professor of History at Notre Dame University and author of the new book, The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Linda Prepyshevsky. She's Associate Professor of History at Notre Dame, and her new book is called The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Linda, I have to say, I laughed a couple of times reading this book. As you move on into the 50s and 60s, clothing begins to get simpler, and your disdain for the childishness of adult clothing. Let's just say you had trouble hiding it, if you meant to at all.
No, I didn't mean to. I don't think I could have suppressed myself that far. I was so surprised when I started doing research on the 1960s to discover just how infantile the mini dress was. And obviously you'd heard about the mini dress and, right, okay, it's modern, it's young, right, but really, really young. In that, it actually resembled what little girls wore, toddler dresses, right? It's a basic A-line, and it's well above the knee. And to me, the really horrifying part was to discover that in certain offices, they had a rule, it's okay to wear mini dresses so long as you are wearing matching underwear. Which means your boss could see your underwear. And that's actually what toddlers wore. Very often, dresses for toddlers came with little matching underwear.
Little bloomers, right.
Bloomers, right. Which they were probably wearing diapers under or something. But for a grown woman to be wearing this, and there are all these stories about women who wanted to be fashionable, so they're wearing the mini dress, which was all the rage in the mid-1960s and later. But how to cope with it. So, for example, the designer Anne Klein started carrying around a large scarf so that when she sat down in business meetings, she could put it over her lap, kind of like a tablecloth, and not flash the men at the business meeting. I was expecting the 1960s to be right about a fashion revolution, okay, but I hadn't really expected it to be such a step backward for women at the same time.
Is that when women's underwear was no longer simply white, beige, or black? Is that how we got colored underpants?
No, there's underwear of various colors, actually quite early on. I mean, the clothing clubs had contests at county fairs across the United States, and at one point the judges were squabbling over whether in the underwear category it was all right if someone put in an entry that was not white cotton.
Wow.
And so obviously the women, you know, who had some money were putting in silks. If a little less money, rayons in various kinds of colors, not usually that bright because you didn't want things to show through, but there's lots of really beautiful examples of, you know, pinks and yellows and pale blues and pale greens and tans, etc., that date way back. And in the 1960s, I still think white was the default color for underwear, because when pantyhose came along, believe it or not, and this was just, you know, said in newspaper and magazine articles, men were so disappointed because they could no longer see that glimpse of white when a woman bent over while wearing a mini skirt. Basically, they were so sorry that she was now wearing pantyhose and they couldn't see her underwear.
Well, they'll just have to live with
that. I'm reading these and going, is nobody embarrassed? Because I'm embarrassed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Solana in Plano. Hi, Solana.
Hello. I have a question about the dressing point system. My grandmother in her jewelry box had a little index card that was, you know, itemized, and this was supposedly the rule to see if you were overdressed. And every little thing counted for a point, a solid sheath dress, 1 point. But if it was floral, it had a belt, fancy sleeve, you had to add on. And I'd like to know if she's heard anything about that, where it came from. I suppose maybe 60s.
Was there a maximum number of points?
I'm trying to remember which dress doctor it was who came up with this idea. But I've actually got two books on this in my collection, but I can't remember her name for sure, so I'm not going to take a stab at it. Yeah, she came up with this idea that you could only wear a certain number of points, and then she, as Solano just said, you each item in your what you were wearing counted for a certain number of points, and then you came up with a final count, and either you took something off or you changed into something more simple. Every time I look at this book, I'm like, why would I want to be doing this much math in the morning? But she was part of a general impulse amongst the dress doctors for simplicity, i.e. you don't want too much going on in your outfit. This was just one version of it. It didn't become really popular in that, as far as I know, she and her books were the only ones who did it. But obviously, from what Solana was saying, there were little cards made up based on this book, and women did actually try to follow it.
We have an email here from Lindsay in Dallas who writes, besides Tim Gunn, who built his reputation on advising women to own fewer pieces and stop wearing ripped jeans, are there any other modern dress doctors that promote those values in the closet?
Oh, you know, I would hesitate to name names because I'm mostly at the moment very much steeped in the past, and no fewer of the living dress doctors. But I have always been struck by the fact that so many style advisors today end up giving you lists of what you must have. And the lists are really long. One of them in one book is like 100 things. And it's like, no, actually, you don't need 100 things. You can live perfectly well, probably with 15. And magazines are always doing the must-haves. You must have this. And my favorite one, it's from several years ago, was an army green parka. And I thought, well, if you're in the army and you're going somewhere cold, you can must have this. But I'm pretty sure the rest of us could live very happily and beautifully without it.
So I went to high school in the 80s, and it was only probably 5 or 7 years after they had discontinued all of the home economics programs. And at the time, we all scoffed at those and thought they were ridiculous. Now, as I'm raising 4 teenagers, it occurs to me that all of us, men and women, could use both home ec classes and shop classes, frankly, to move into adult life. Why did the home economics movement in particular and so many of the things that allowed the dress doctors to do what they did fall out of fashion?
It actually starts in the 50s, which, you know, almost sounds anti-intuitive. The dress doctors who were part of home economics departments at the land-grant universities came under pressure from university presidents who were more interested in the hard sciences because they wanted to do their part for the Cold War. And, you know, you can't knock Sputnik out of the sky and beat the Russians with home economics. It's not happening. So programs disappeared. University of Chicago program disappeared, for example. Teachers College, Columbia University, University of California at Berkeley. All of those programs were dismantled in the 1950s. Then comes the 1960s and the women's movement. You can think of Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique and this real anger against a strictly domestic life for women. Now, the home economists would have said, well, we don't actually argue for that. We're training professional women. We're training home women. We try to do both. But they got a lot of criticism for encouraging stereotypes, girls are just domestic, et cetera. And then funding started being cut in the 1970s at the federal level and then the state level. But I think you're right. We can actually look to the different facets of home economics and see what we've lost. For example, nutrition. Right, nutrition training was a central part of home economics, and a lot of people worry that we have a problem with obesity because people don't know how to cook and they don't know how to eat properly. Financial knowledge, budgeting. Budgeting was part of every dress doctor's book, and they would give you examples of a family and say, okay, here's the Abel family. They make this much a year. They've got 4 children. How much should each one of these people get to spend on clothing? Right, so you'd have to work out an entire budget. So I do think in many ways, if you looked at old textbooks from home economics classes, not just those that cover dress, but those that cover everything from child care to home decorating to dress to finances, you know, basically consumer science, you would be struck by how valuable so much of that information would still be today.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Linda on the line in Denton, another Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hey, love the point that you guys are making about home ec and shop being made requirements for both genders. I think that's a terrific idea. I'm a sociologist, and I just wanted to mention, I think that looking at women's rights and women's equality vis-a-vis fashion is pretty important. And oftentimes during the 60s, for example, I think women's infantilization, if you will, by the mini dresses, was a way to kind of keep us less threatening to men as we were, you know, expanding our range and getting more rights and going into the workforce. Look at the 70s when we were put into those horrible big-shouldered jackets and those tie things around our necks. It looked like bandages around our necks. You remember that stuff? Where we were very masculinized, so we wouldn't be too sexy in the workplace.
Right. That's really interesting.
Yeah. What happens in the 1970s is John Malloy, who wrote the Dress for Success books for men and got men into more conservative suits after the 70s had, sort of created the Peacock Revolution, then did the same thing for women. And he argued very strongly against the 70s haute couture fashion, which was, if you may remember, Yves Saint Laurent did a lot of peasant looks, for example, very expensive silk, but still peasant looks. And Malloy argued that and he actually did these surveys of business people sending people in wearing various things and seeing how people reacted to them. And he argued that if women got into suits, right, that they would, and he always recommended if you can only buy one suit, make it gray, which I think is depressing, but there it is. And then you will be taken more seriously. And he claimed that thousands of women wrote him and thanked him for helping them up the ladder to success in business. But what I noticed is because in the 60s and 70s, we'd already lost this design vocabulary. The only suits that people really came up with looked like men's suits, right? They were cut like men's suits, just like that little sad tie was kind of a bad men's tie. And realized that, you know, from the 50s all the way back in the 20th century, women wore suits, and there was a terrific variety. They were fitted to women's bodies. They weren't like the 70s suits, which were very masculine. And we forgot about all that, and I think partly forgot about it because we got that simplification in the late 60s and 70s, and the dress doctors kind of got put out of business, and they weren't there to say, you know what, there are actually very professional and beautiful ways for women to dress if they're going to go into business.
How did the dress doctors look at the ideal form for a woman's body? These days, very few of us actually match it, but we all know what the perfect body is supposed to look like.
Body today is supposed to be really skinny, although sometimes it looks like you're also supposed to have very large breasts, mm-hmm. which is a really odd combination.
Like Barbie, right.
Yeah. And I've got a picture in the book that I really love that is the ideal body type as based on Greek statuary and Western art. And she's got hips. And every time I look at it, I think, yes, that's fine. I could aim for that. And this is supposed to be the beautiful female form. So to me, it's interesting because on the one hand, they did expect women to wear girdles, which are clearly about containing hips. On the other hand, they did assume, this classical body as what is beautiful. Now, they did expect it to be, because this comes from the Greeks, to be sort of more taller than usual, a figure which is 8 heads high, i.e. if you took your head and you measured it, you would be a total of 8 heads high. And that's tall. That is really darn tall. And that's the one thing I always thought was difficult to achieve, let's put it that way.
There's really no way to get around it.
No.
Do you see any kind of return to this, or is this really an era that we have passed by forever?
I think there's been really interesting activity that comes out of a couple of cultural phenomena. If you think about Project Runway, mm-hmm. that got a lot of young people thinking about, oh, you can create clothing. Imagine that. I could get a sewing machine, too. And there has been an increase in the number of young people applying to fashion design schools. Mm-hmm. I think Mad Men alerted a lot of people who had not really thought about how different clothing in the past was to just how beautiful and polished clothing had been.
Got to jump in because we're out of time. Linda Prebyszewski's new book is called The Lost Art of Dress, The Women Who Once Made America Stylish. Linda, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.